Okay, so thank you, Fiona. I'll start off and then hand over to Debbie. So first of all, this piece of work was commissioned by the Research for Development Impact Network, which, as Fiona mentioned, is a collaboration. It used to be called the Alfred Universities Network, some of you may have heard of, and is a collaboration across Australian universities with ACFID and ACFID members, looking at how to promote effective ethical development research and its uptake towards development impact, hence the name. And this piece of work was looking at the ADRES grants, which were competitive grants, and trying to understand better how what were the mechanisms that led to impact and what were some of those impacts. Sorry, I was going to mention. So Debbie was commissioned to undertake the work, and I'll let her speak a little bit about her background and why she's the most apt person to be having a look at these. And the other people listed here have been on a kind of steering group interacting with Debbie around the study. So first of all, evidence in the aid program. I mean, I think the fact that there's 500 people attending this conference, talking about evidence and aid is testament to its ongoing importance in the aid program. And yes, we might have shifted focus slightly about where and how that evidence is needed, but it's clear that we need effective ways to fund it, effective ways to fund it in ways that will ensure it leads to development impact, that it's not just going to lead to research that happens in an ivory tower somewhere, but it's going to engage with aid initiatives, with partner governments, with multiple stakeholders so that it can actually provoke and deliver change. So just a quick slide on the network. So as I mentioned, it's a network that's about the importance of evidence in aid, and I'd encourage you all to join. It's free membership. It will help connect you to the community of people who care about the same issue. And there is another conference in June in Sydney, which we have some flyers about. That's probably all I want to say. I'm not great at advertising spiels, but I would encourage you all to join. And Philippa in the front here and Jenny are both parts of a secretariat who keep that network functioning. So why did we want to have a look at the ADRES research grants? So first of all, in 2015, ODE did a study, which was one of the few studies which has tried to look systematically at the use of evidence in the aid program. It had quite a narrow focus. It was just looking at uptake within DFAT of research, and of course it had quite mixed outcomes. And when that report came out, many of us were thinking, well, you know, what about all the other stakeholders for research? We shouldn't just be thinking about DFAT as a department and its uptake. We should be thinking about how is development research having an impact much more widely. And so we decided that it would be important to look at the ADRES grants, which were an investment of $60 million over many years, which opened up and then have now closed down, and that it's really important for us to look at and have a systematic view of, well, what impacts did they lead to and what were the mechanisms that led to those impacts? What does that tell us about the effective ways to fund development research? So I'm going to now hand to Debbie, who has been doing all the hard yards.
And just to mention on the impact as well, to say to the ODE evaluation was actually initially meant to look at those wider impacts of research, and it was particularly only because of the timing, etc., for that. And my statement about that will relate to what Juliet was referring to. So I was research director and advisor in AusAID at the time of initiating the ADRA grants and the research strategy. So we did talk a lot about managing conflict of interest and that sort of thing, but I promise you, tried to be as objective as I could about this. And so just to mention as well, the other reason that we wanted to look at it specifically was we tried with the ADRES to have a lot of emphasis on having an upfront communication and engagement strategy, requiring communication and engagement reports, having a workshop where people had to identify their key stakeholders, interact with DFAT, etc. So tried to do what we could to promote from the outset, and we learned each year how to do that better, that the impact, the practical impacts of the work. But they've never actually been explored. So that's what this was about. So what did we do? We first of all did a document review of the past ADRA documentation, but also a lot looking at the various frameworks. What's really interesting is this research, evidence on research impact and how to measure it, how to represent it, is a massively growing field. In the last, more than 90% of the papers that have been published in that field have been published in the last 15 years. And so it's a really rapidly growing field. So for people that are actually doing development research, what was interesting for me looking at this, with some of the papers coming out of the ADRA projects, a couple of the ADRA projects that had actually written a paper about how they'd achieved impact, what pathways there were, what the barriers were, that paper was cited more than the paper that was actually about the results of the research. So it shows you the interest in that sort of broader research impact analysis. Then the phase twos, we did it in four phases. Then after that, also at the beginning, we interviewed people at DFAT and other research funders, primarily DFAT. DFAT was our primary target audience for this, but also other key institutions and research funders. We emailed targeted questions to a 50% sample of the ADRAs. So we took a representative sample but of the 2007 to 2009 ADRAs, because evidence suggests that the impacts take a while to achieve and the 2012 round ADRAs are largely just finishing now. And so we took the 2007 to 2009, but we did look at a few 2012 ones where they were in new sectors that hadn't existed before, so mining, WASH, etc. So we did the email questionnaire and then significant follow-up with each researcher after getting the responses back to the email questionnaire as well, just clarifying, getting more information on certain things. And then we did a series of in-depth case studies, which I'll talk about more, and then now we're just preparing the targeted communication on findings, so briefings, all sorts that we can do to try and get the information out there. So we developed a framework that we're calling FERDI. I haven't seen a FERDI. And most people that know me will tell you I hate duplication. So I hate, there are so many frameworks out there already. And so the last thing I wanted to do was develop another research impact framework. But when we reviewed them all, there were a few things specific to development research that weren't covered very well in the others. And so we did develop our own, but to say that really this is an adapted version of the payback framework, which is the one that's most frequently used in research impact assessment. So as you see, it combines, what it does is it combines a model of research, the research process, and I hate to call it a logic model because the circles try and show that it's not necessarily linear, and then it also talks about categories of outcome as well. What's different about ours is we separated out uptake and use, as well as the outcome, output, etc. process, and I'll talk about why a bit later on in the presentation. And also we had a lot more emphasis on understanding the context of what was going on and how important that is for research, and also the engagement and knowledge exchange across, but that's quite common, but also the capacity building that occurs across the research cycle process. So what we found is the funders of research had these interests for research, and those were the types of impacts that they wanted. What I wanted to point out here is what stood out to me is there's a little bit of mismatch, not always, but between shorter in time frames, so 3 years was too long, 2 years was on the edge, according to some of the development research funders, shorter, punchier, etc. But the impacts that we were most interested in was job creation, livelihood change, poverty reduction, budgets changing. So there's a little bit of mismatch between short, punchy research and then the impact that we hope that that achieves. But what I thought was interesting is one person who had worked in the Pacific for a number of years mentioned that they thought that research that changed enduring narratives was very important, that particularly in the Pacific region there was a lot of assumption that if you repeat something three times it must be true, and in fact, some research that he had found most useful had actually shown evidence otherwise and changed a policy narrative in the Pacific, for working in the Pacific. So that was interesting. Just a breakdown quickly of the ADRAs. Health was the biggie. Economics was a biggie. They're the main ones. Disability as well, which was good to see. So did it have outcomes? Yes, it did. And so we found a range of policy practice outcomes, and I promise you I'm not biased as a health economist, but I have to say that health was a bit of the star player here. The health ADRAs were the sector that probably had more impacts than others. But here's a range of the outcomes that we saw. So actually, in Fiji, from a translation research project, changes to taxation policy for palm oil and also for getting rid of the tax on importing vegetables, so that people had more access in Fiji to cheaper vegetables to change diet. So that was an NCD program. Customary law changing. At the end of last year, PNG just passed a tobacco bill. When that bill was first drafted, all companies, everyone trading in tobacco, were treated the same, whether you were British American Tobacco or whether you were a local supplier who sold a bit of tobacco that you grew in the market. And the person that did a ADRA on public health law in the Pacific had done a paper on customary health law, and she's now working in PNG, and they picked up that, and she changed added into the law in PNG some considerations around customary providers, what the local markets should be able to do, and separated out big tobacco from local producers. And she said that really came out of the work that she did as part of this ADRA, developing that customary law paper. We had roads widened in PNG. This is an amazing program, but we're running out of time, so I won't go into it too much now because we'll get to the case study. We saw changed approaches to how the poor were targeted in health equity funds, and a Nossal Institute research program, and two ADRAs actually, was in response to a specific targeted question from the government in Cambodia about whether they should be rolling out health equity funds or community-based health insurance. ADRA project was funded that would give the evidence base for that, and that evidence base was used to roll out health equity funds in preference to community-based health insurance. So health equity funds, people don't have to contribute. Community-based health insurance, they do. And then capacity. The case studies we used, just to quickly put up, we actually used a realist contributions framework for the case studies. So what that means is we had to come up with what we thought theories of change might be to the impacts initially as a proposed theory, and then refine that as you're doing the evaluation, refining that together with the research teams, the stakeholders. This was one for disability inclusive road development in Papua New Guinea. And it was great sitting around the table with the head of the PNG Assembly for Disabled Persons, the researchers coming up with this, refining it, etc. And that project had impacts through to changes in road development. 4 of the 10 researchers, all the researchers were people with disabilities in PNG. 4 of them have now gone on to a research and advocacy career in disability. So what we found in the 3 case studies that we've completed so far, I should have said this is a work in progress. We're getting more information now on the final case studies. What was interesting for me was that 3 of them really represented 3 types of impact from development research, or ways of getting that impact. One was that it had all of the conditions for impact. People that were going to be affected by the program were included. They had a road contractor engineer from the private sector included in the team. There was a whole lot of conditions for impact, but not the policy environment. But because they had every other component that you could possibly imagine on how to try and get impact from the start, they did. They targeted impact, the NOSA one, clear policy question, clear relationship with government, trust, bang, here's the answer, that answer was implemented. And then emergent impact, because really Genevieve Hauser's project on the model public health law was her own interest and background, but then with the disease outbreaks that happened, WHO became fascinated by capacity to implement the international health regulations, and Genevieve's work's now gone global and she's been asked to develop tools in the Middle East, in the Pacific, all over the place, looking at health legislation review. So that's really a contextual external influence that's given that impetus to impact. So what were the main influences? Starting with the end in mind, was frustrating a little. It seems simple, but much more difficult to get people to actually think about. I'm going to put the one fact, beware the word exploring or exploratory work. That was one of the main things on influence, on impact. Networks and engagement, obviously, but particularly the first one, having that in-country partner that was going to be there post-research, but one that really had ownership of the research. And that is different from just getting what you need from them. I've got them in the research team, etc., but they own the research and they continued advocacy with the road engineer and the head of the PNG Assembly for Disabled Persons on past the project. So two things, and I know I need to stop. Two things. One issue was the boundary of responsibility of researchers. So a lot of the researchers stopped at take-up. We know that we presented to these policymakers. We know that we did all these wonderful things to get the research taken up, but we don't know how it was used. We don't know what the impacts were. That plus thinking, and then someone actually said you need someone that actually knows more about implementing results, so works in the practice policy sectors to take the research forward into practice. And then that got me thinking about the way that innovation projects are funded, which is usually separate stages, that you have a concept funding, you have implementation, testing, etc. And really shouldn't we have something like that for development research in general, where less should be spent on exploratory big analysis that doesn't get the impact necessarily, and more then through the process of take up, and then finally for researchers to be able to monitor their own impact. The end. Sorry.
Well, thank you, Debbie and Juliet, for that. Our second set of panelists. It's exciting that we have a full house, right? That's actually more important than that we can find seats. Our second panelist is Dr. Neil Nazaro. Thank you. The panel is, the paper is on the impact evaluation of Australia Aid. How successful was the DFAT CSIRO Research for Development Alliance? And our presenter, Dr. Neil Nazaro, is a senior research consultant with the CSIRO Land and Water. The project is about is a strategic partnership aimed to improve the impact of aid and was established in 2007, completed in 2016. And I believe Dr. Lazaro will now tell us many of the important findings related to how successful was that research. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Yao. Good morning, everyone. I feel like a bit of an imposter. I've only been working in the aid space less than 10 years, and looks like over the course of the conference there's a few seasoned heads around here, so I'm sure they'll pick a lot of holes in my presentation. So firstly, this is a group effort, so CSIRO, Griffith, NRM, and a whole number of in-country partners. So the Research for Development Alliance brought together our research skills and those of our partners with the aid and network skills of DFAT, Australian Aid, with the aim of reducing global poverty and building the capacity of our in-country partners essentially to reduce poverty. We had six major projects from 2009 to 2014, and they really focused on global development issues, so climate, water, sustainable cities, and food security. The total value of the project was about $22 million, with six coming from us and 16 from DFAT. And the projects spanned national level down to local level scales. So this just gives you a flavour of where we worked and what we did. So six projects is about 30 case studies in total. This is one example, so the high-resolution climate downscaling project for Vietnam. So we did climate projections for Vietnam and the region. And in the first column, you can see the kinds of deliverables that came out of the project and some idea of the uptake or outscaling of the work. So in the first case, the climate projections would improve and inform national policy development, but we learned very quickly as the project developed and came to the conclusion that there was huge interest from other government agencies and in the sector in taking up that work further. So all of the projections are, for example, publicly available now, and that information has been used for regional planning, provincial planning in Vietnam and other regions, other countries in the region. So that's just one, I guess, a bit of a flavour of one of the projects. So a previous speaker spoke about the research payback model. This is another bastardisation of that model, but you can see that, and many of us have done it. But basically, you know, the further away you are from household or individual actions, the harder it is to necessarily create strong attributions for projects. And so one of our projects really sat at the household level, this project in Nusa Tenggara Barat province in Indonesia, but all of the others were much further away from the household level, delivered to national or other types of policy makers. So what I'm here to talk about today is our efforts to evaluate the impact of the alliance. And you'll know from your own efforts, your own work, that it's often very hard to do that impact evaluation at project completion, to understand, especially for knowledge service type products as opposed to vaccinations, for example, at project completion. Those welfare benefits are very hard to ascertain. And we see sometimes that when impact evaluations are done, some of the uncertainties remain large and are potentially larger than the actual benefits that are described. And so that's problematic if your job is about investing Australia's taxation money in international development. So we came up with an impact evaluation approach to test our overall project theory of change, which is really that partner government policies and donor development programs are influenced by the Alliance Research for Development. Just noticed you there. And are leading to reduce poverty. So are we actually making a difference? So in the following slides, I'm just going to pick out a few of the steps and describe, give you a flavour of the results and the detail. I also want to note that as we came to the end of this initial evaluation, Worker received a small funding boost from ODE that allowed it to redo the second step. And to the best of my knowledge, it's the first time that DFAT or ODE has funded a post-project completion impact evaluation piece of work. So I'll talk a little bit about that too. So I guess like all projects, in our theory of change, moves through three stages. So initial capacity building through to policy and program development, and then essentially the outscaling that could take a number of different forms. And as we move up through, and so this is from the Indonesian project, and you can see the goal up here, which is really about increasing the capacity of rural communities to reduce their vulnerability to climate change and adverse impacts. So as we move through this evolution, the stakeholders scale out from the researchers to our boundary partners, essentially to the welfare beneficiaries. And generally speaking, project completion is here. So we finish the project there, and you know, this is the aspiration that the project work will be scaled out and eventually there'll be some sort of impact. So this is a populated example. So what we did is we went to our research partners in four of the case studies, and we asked them how well the project did. So this example here, the numbers are immaterial, except to say that I got that wrong. So the red is from 2014 and the yellow is from 2015. So we went back a year later and asked them the same series of questions. And we found a few interesting things. So firstly, so this is a project in Vietnam, in Can Tho, in the Mekong region, and with a couple of main deliverables that were very clearly identifiable and different to those being produced by other organisations working in that region. As you know, it's quite a crowded region in terms of international development. So rainwater harvesting guidebook, a water atlas with clearly identifiable products and different, I guess, informed to the kind of knowledge services and capacity building activities that a number of different agencies and organisations were doing. So what we found when we did our impact evaluation through this step, talking to our research partners in country, so we'd left a year later and we simply started to lose contact with the way our work was being used, but our research partners were much closer to that and were able to identify how some of that work had been taken up. And by going into a workshop process with them at project completion and a year later, we're able to identify where our work was actually having some type of impact. So the point I made before, specifically identifiable products that are different in kind to those produced by other organisations are much more clearly identifiable and attributable. The other thing we also picked up is that, you know, although the beginning here is really around the capacity building, the knowledge development phase, we found that capacity building and knowledge development increased and improved as we move through these other phases over here. So although the project actually finished, we found that our project partners were developing their knowledge and were able to use the different skills around water resource management to design and develop other types of projects. And for example, the city of Cantor was actually able to digitise some of the work we'd done, and they were using it for more broad scale regional planning. So stuff we hadn't conceptualised when we initially framed the project and rolled it out, and it was being used in an innovative way by our research partners. So the second stage of the impact evaluation work was a quantitative survey with end users. So these are generally speaking policy makers, and we did about 15 to 20 surveys per case study. What you're seeing over here is the 2014 results and then the 2015 results. This is the sister project to the one in Cantor. We had two urban development projects, so really looking at water, emergency management, vulnerability, physical infrastructure in Makassar in Indonesia. And we're able to find a number of interesting... So this is our poster child for how projects move through impact evaluation, by the way. They don't all look like this. So these are the three stages, from capacity building to program policy development to then outscaling. And you can see this evolution over even a short period, 12 months, of how the project outputs are moving through the impacts and then essentially beneficiaries. And so we had... So the survey had 18 questions. It came out of the social ecological systems research. That's sort of the theoretical foundation for the work. And this is just a snapshot of some of the findings we've got. So through the three project stages, we had six questions for each. And I just wanted to point you to the bottom result over here. So this is us asking end users whether there'd been a welfare benefit, an end-user beneficiary that actually had an improvement. And what we found between 2014 and 2015 was, I guess I'd call, a correction. So when we initially did the surveys, people were really optimistic about how these research benefits would flow out. And a year later, when they hadn't really seen that, they actually corrected their responses, and we saw a downgrading of that result. I'll make one other point here. So we all know that, you know, DFAT can sometimes be quite fluid in terms of staffing and positioning. That same thing is the case with a number of the countries, all of the countries that we went in and did our survey work. It was very hard to find some of the people who did the survey the first year. Mostly when we did find them, they were often working on other projects and they'd somewhat lost touch of some of the work that we'd done. So we had to work through all of those issues. And we've been able to document some of that. Thank you. So the third step of the project was benefit cost analysis. I'll make the confession firstly that the projects were never designed at inception to do BCA, and so we had to retrofit this to the work. And so the project that most closely related to end user benefits was the one in NTB in Indonesia, where we were looking at village and household benefits, and that was the one that was most amenable to BCA. There were 12 case studies in total. We looked at two of them. So the first was this castor and maize intercropping project, and the second was a seaweed farming project, essentially creating a new innovative piece of infrastructure for seaweed farming that was more robust to storms, storm events. And what we found was that project completion, this first project, was already returning a positive a positive benefit, and the second project was not positive, but wasn't far away from it. We used a fairly conservative economic analysis to try and understand what this diffusion might look like over time. And this over here, this if diffusion occurs in the way we think it might, the value of this single case study over here, so this is 1 in 12 and it's 1 project in 6, is worth more than the whole of the lines over the 5 years. So an interesting take on benefit-cost analysis. The second step of our benefit-cost analysis was to try and look at a portfolio-level analysis. So, if you're a decision maker, if you're an investor in international development, one of the things you often struggle with is how to select from a subset of potential projects to maximise benefits if you're constrained within budgets. And so, we try to understand how to do that through portfolio analysis. So this is one of our projects in the Mekong region. And really the aim of this project, one of the main aims, was to try and move decision maker beliefs about what was most likely to uplift the most impoverished. So the initial perception was that large-scale irrigation was likely to have the best benefit. And what we found, and what we actually have statistically proven, is that by the end of the project, there was a clear understanding that large-scale irrigation is not a one-size-fits-all, and the most poor, the most marginal people were often left out of that because they weren't landowners or they lived in hilly regions which were not amenable to them. And so we wanted to ask the question, what if we took some of the money that was likely to be invested in large-scale irrigation and invested in other things? So what we did is essentially a canned version. This is just to demonstrate the applicability of this work. So we said, well, if we took some money out of large-scale irrigation and invested in a portfolio across education, agricultural R&D, and infrastructure, what might that look like? And essentially where we arrived at the project was that, if we're able to attribute 1%, so if 1%, 1 million of that 100 million that might be reinvested is actually attributable to where our project landed, which is to shift decision makers, then we're seeing our project returning after project cost a 12-to-1 benefit. And what might that look like? How might that inform decision making? Then what we try to do is to say, well, how could we visualise this? How could we turn this into... This is a still, obviously, of a piece of software we've developed. How could we visualise that type of information into sort of on-the-fly decision support tool? And so this just describes what I've told you. So essentially what we did is you can see R&D, education, so there's a range of different projects there. These are all the large-scale irrigations. And there's a whole range of indicators over here, including discount rate, including the price of rice, for example. And these are all constrained by back-end data set with multiple-to-multiple relationships, which essentially asks the question, if I was to invest X amount of money in this or in a portfolio, what might the benefits look like over time? So essentially the back end to this is informed by all of those impact evaluation and R4D studies that exist over time, not all, but the selection of. But the point here was to demonstrate that it is possible to potentially develop an on-the-fly tool to assist decision-making when you're faced with that point of investing across the portfolio. And you can also constrain, you can say, well, for political reasons, I don't need to invest this much in this project because, person X made a promise to person Y. So it's an all or nothing kind of approach. So the last thing we did was look at, review of practice, of course, across the suite of projects. I'll be very quick here because the previous talk mentioned all of the key points. So strong partnerships are, of course, critical. Flexibility is really important, and the main thing around flexibility is, of course, being amenable to new partners coming on. And we saw that in Cantor with Save the Children came on and partnered and took some of our work and has now rolled it out to over 200 households. The last thing is around this review of practice, so the critical science themes. Of course, water is important, the relationship between the landscape and socioeconomic issues. And, in the short to medium term, the drivers of vulnerability, population growth, urbanisation, migration are just critical, and we need to understand those in more detail. So finally, as I mentioned before, we think overall the projects delivered a good benefit. impact evaluation, the way we structure it, we think has been really useful and can inform decision making. And we think there's real value in further developing this on the fly tool that we've compiled with our partner Woolly Parsons. So I can say that our approach is already raising the bar within CIRA for some of the work we're doing and with some of our development partners. Thank you.
Thank you, Neil. Our third paper is going to be presented by the panelists, Professor Eric Dilger, as part of the PNG University of Technology team. And the paper is on sustaining the international public good of the state-supported research university so as to meet SDG 4. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I was looking for that earlier. That's fine. Thanks. Okay. Okay. Hi. I'm presenting this research on behalf of myself and our Vice Chancellor, Albert Schramm, who, because of a family emergency, could not get here to with us today. What we're looking at, just to give you the overview, is the notion that in Papua New Guinea currently, we have six universities working, two large public research universities, University of Papua New Guinea and Philip Moresby, which is the liberal arts and laws, you know, focus, and then the PNG University of Technology, or Unitech, which is engineering and such, including also communication development studies, business studies and architecture. So that's where I am from. And we're talking about the importance amidst tight budgets, ever tighter budgets, having it's important to meet the SDG goal 4 on education to support state-supported research universities with appropriate budgets. Okay, the main points. In both developed and underdeveloped nations, the public good aspect of public university is subject to increased scrutiny by both policymakers and taxpayers, leading to diverse policy outcomes. There's been all this debate about, in the United States, for example, that why we move to student loans for funding more and more of higher education, where our state investments in state higher education has been decreasing. The idea is that when people go to university, they get a private good as well as a public good given to the society as a whole. Therefore, if it's primarily thought of as a private good, then the students should fund it themselves. In the neoliberal USA and UK, this has been happening. In the less developed countries, LGCs, the notion has been that, though, that higher education is a benefit of a public good to help in the building the nation. And then therefore striking a sustainable interest balance between individual, collective, and the present future is more critical of the developing world where the needs are more extensive and the resources more stretched. The UN SDG 4 calls that governments and civil society everywhere need to ensure inclusive and equitable quality education and promote lifelong learning opportunities for all. We believe that public universities are best placed to ensure these outcomes in their locales, not centralized ministries. Therefore, overseas development aid should support such institutions by providing both standards for access to higher education in terms of program, tuition fees, and scalability, as well as promoting global accreditation standards for quality of programs provided. Higher education is a public good. We need to understand education public good causes massive positive externalities because, of course, more educated people you have in a nation, the better generally, and all sorts of outcomes. Number two, special importance of universities and countries' innovation system, where do you get new ideas? Number three, contributing of universities to regional and the national economy, and the increase in access. That is, the more people get into higher education and graduate, it also increases your tax base. That's a 5-7 year time lag. Okay, most countries have a mixed higher education system with both private and public universities playing complementary roles. Private universities developing countries nonetheless. The problem is, well, ECK and PNG, we have a problem where the government is now allowing some government funds to go to private universities. There are currently in Papua New Guinea two functioning private universities, Divine Word University in Madang and Pacific Adventist University in Port Moresby. And these are primarily teaching institutions and not doing much research. So that's the issue there. And then secondly, but for governments like Papua New Guinea, it seems like a win-win because they graduate a lot of undergraduates who are supposedly work job ready for the labor market, and they don't cost the state much of anything. So that's the attraction. So why public universities? Why have them? True public universities defined? We should have one, an autonomous institution where its trained teaching and research missions are exercised independent of all political authority and economic power. Two, a place where teaching and research is inseparable. And a locus that values academic freedom. This comes from Magna Carta Universitatum statement. The third mission of public universities, that is the service mission, service to all, according to the Talaris Declaration on Civic Roles and Social Responsibilities of Higher Education, third mission of university public service include the creation of social capital, the fostering of social responsibility in faculty, staff, and students, the declared commitment to gaining social good, which is to promote a democratic and just society. And then finally, we carry a unique obligation to listen, understand, and contribute to social transformation and development. Higher education must extend itself for the good of society to enhance communities near and far, and therefore promote core missions of teaching, research, and service. Okay, now, this issue I'm turning to now is the issue of what we call the iron triangle of sort of higher education provision. Here's a triangle. You have cost factors on one end, you have access factors on the other end, and you have quality and cost. So it's cost on one end, quality on the other end, and access and on the third. And the point is, they usually say you can get two, not all three. Like if you promote access, increase access, students to higher education, usually the quality suffers if the cost stays the same, that type of thing. Okay? So you have this sort of idea. Two out of three of them can be achieved. Equality is made the cornerstone, the trilemma not holding for low-income countries with a graduate enrollment rate of under 10%, since there's some time lag. And aid might be needed in transition because benefits are recognized with a lag, realized with lag. The issue here is that in places like PNG, the enrollment in higher education is very small as part of the population. Like I would say, in PNG we have a population of about 7-8 million, and yet the higher education total enrollment is like 10,000, 15,000 students a year. Okay. So very small. Okay. One of the problems, though, in developing countries generally, and this goes back to Ronald Dore, back in 76, talked about this in his book, The Diploma Disease. He said that universities in developing countries copy Western universities and focus on paper examinations. And the idea is people need a university credential, even if it's not focused on a specific area of study, to just get into the door of government employment or any formal employment. So this sets up a problem where it makes it where there's mismatch in the labor markets, and also it promotes brain drain when people with degrees cannot get useful employment. Okay. So the idea is it's almost like it comes in an arms race. Students have to gain ever more functionally unneeded qualifications to distinguish themselves in an increasingly crowded job field. Over time, this created false demand leads to creation of shortcuts, such as low-cost, even bogus degrees offered by online for-profit providers, or not always online, one of the problems that faced in Liberia, Afghanistan, and I think now in Papua New Guinea, is the explosion of unaccredited universities online and such that promise degrees, you know, first degrees, second degrees, PhD degrees, but they're not properly accredited. And students lose money and opportunity cost. Now, this is the diagram that Dory gave us about how the diploma cycle, disease cycle works. You know, we use in the center there, use of certificates for job allocation. And so the arrows move around. You end up with intense demand for schooling and certificates. Then it puts pressures on budget. Then it puts pressure for tertiary spending, education. Then the idea of trying to, if not everyone has to go to college to be successful, then it tends to overlook the skill sets that people need to develop in primary schooling. Then it turns to examination-oriented teaching, ritualization of the learning process, deformation of minds and characters to be successful, and so forth. And then you end up, as we often find, with educated unemployment, that is graduates who graduate but can't get a job, and then qualification escalation, and then back again. Now, appropriate aid to universities. If university education provides a public good, any aid must help create necessary conditions such as commitment to forward-looking leadership, transparency and best practice in governance, quality standards, international accreditation, fostering university industry relations, and promoting efficiency in operations. And we're trying to do this very much at my current at Papua New Guinea University of Technology, under Vice Chancellor Schramm's leadership there. So we're working on these issues. Appropriate aid to universities. Such aid to universities support the following institutional actions. Increased access for deserving students through an efficient, focused, and targeted scholarship scheme. And then also by embracing instructional scalability, by blended learning. One of the problems we have, 5 minutes, okay? One of the problems we have is we're restricted, even though our campus is physically large, we're restricted to intake of around 3,000 students. The government, through its higher education policy, they had a free education policy at the lower levels, and so now they'll have a lot of grade 12 graduates that they want the universities to take, but we physically can't take more. One problem we have is the government chronically underfunds us. So we have, a $30 million a year is what we should have in funding, but we only get maybe 10 million. So we're opening that notion of satellite campuses using blended learning through mobile telephone providers and so forth to at least get students started on their higher education access. Okay. So, one of the problems was the Millennium Development Goals, the earlier MDG goals, had excluded higher education from the goal. Now, we say that was a mistake because universities contribute to goal and development of the rest of the education system, but cannot be underestimated. You know, if education is a key, then the question is who's going to teach the teachers? The higher education. So the idea of training the workforce for the near and current mid-term horizon. Public and research universities specifically contribute to a country's innovation system, therefore its long-term development prospects. Fortunately, the role of higher education has now been recognized in the SDG goals. This revision provides a framework for concerted action to support the development of sustainable and functional higher education sector by private and public development partners. But these policies must be driven by grounded, qualified academic practitioners who know the lay of the land where they serve. You should try to use, when you're doing development projects on higher education in developing countries, use the people, the talented people on the ground. You don't need to fly in somebody and have them for a week or two, and then they dictate what the policy should be. Support public universities adequately and carry out agreed policies to improve the quality and delivery of academic programs. Katsatia Struma has advocated to create a new type of innovation universities, thank you, which would ensure high-level coordination between government and non-governmental actors. While awaiting this development, however, the current strategy to transform existing universities and strengthen research, community service, and commercialization must be given a chance. That is, the university should, like Unitech has a large property with many houses and buildings and resources that we could, if we had some funds and private partnerships, investments, we could monetize to fund the university. The ODA, Overseas Development Aid, should play a key role in this effort. Finally, we should not do this because it's easy, because it's hard. Merely surrendering to the latest policy fad or to political convenience will not long-term create a credible, a viable higher education sector in Papua New Guinea. And there's that. Some issues again. One of the problems, just real quick, that faces specifically in Papua New Guinea recently, we have a new 2014 Higher Education Act, which basically has taken autonomy for the appointment of the chancellor and vice chancellor away from the university councils and given it to the government. That's not going to help our academic freedom. The funding, as I've already mentioned, has been really cut back, and so that makes it hard to do the research. And so that is the main issues we face in Papua New Guinea right now. So the idea is DFAT or others who want to fund should look at those foundational issues in higher education aid. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric. Our fourth paper is on assessing research impact insights from knowledge system and rapid framework. It will be presented by Mr. Federico D'Elia from and the team is a project between SESTINIO as well as ACIAR. So without further ado, sir.
Thank you very much, Fiona. It's that awkward moment when you're the final speaker and most of your things have been covered by the previous speakers, ranging from adapting frameworks and cost benefit analysis, SLP. This is a project, a relatively small project we did as part of ACR's impact assessment series. We worked very closely with Andrew Alford, who's the impact assessment manager at ACR. And our purpose was to capture the non-quantifiable dimensions of research investments. So the very rough outline for today, this is the published version, which you can access online. We developed this framework for adapting existing frameworks to capture how research funding influences things like education and policy in emerging economies. So I'm going to start off by telling you about the case study, which was aflatoxin reduction investments that ACIA funded in the early 2000s. And then based on that project, we were given the task to, because the outcomes of the project were not economically quantifiable as such. It was more important to capture how the knowledge generated was being used by researchers and policymakers in Indonesia. So aflatoxin broadly is a carcinogenic fungus which develops in human environments. It's a fairly major problem in Southeast Asia, and it affects both humans and livestock. In the context of Indonesia, which is where ACR was investing in this project, the context of Indonesia is that peanuts are obviously quite commonly consumed informally at markets, in satay sources, and aflatoxin at the policy level is monitored when peanuts are coming into the country, but not the domestic production, largely because of issues of enforcement and the scale of production, just thousands of peanut producers. And some major issues in Indonesia that at the time, before ACR invested, was lack of knowledge of where aflatoxin was occurring and where it could be targeted best in that peanut value chain, ranging from the production to the consumer. And so there was a need for understanding. There were very little incentives for on point management and the complexity of on point management around the toxin. And the fungus unfortunately works, you're more likely to develop liver cancer if you also have Hep B, and the high incidence of Hep B in India coupled with access to infected peanuts is a high health risk. So that was the context at the time in which ASA said, let's try and discover ways to reduce aflatoxin risk. So this is what ASA did in the early 2000s. It was about a five-year project, $1 million, so it wasn't huge. It was targeted only at Indonesia, and it was a partnership between Queensland researchers and Indonesian researchers. And it was very much focused on reducing aflatoxin in peanuts through technical means. It was very much about identifying where aflatoxin occurs in the value chain as a way of reducing aflatoxin in the long term. They did this through a series of technical projects. So they surveyed the value chain to try and identify where it occurred the most. And they found that it was in the informal markets, what they call the wet markets, where peanuts are stored and the humidity triggers the development of aflatoxin. They found that was the best place to intervene in the value chain because it was much more trackable than in the smallholder farming context of Indonesia. They also, between Australian growers and Indonesian researchers, developed a series of computer tools to try and monitor the best conditions to basically farm peanuts to try and reduce aflatoxin at that farm level. So we discussed this project with ASIC, where you developed quite a range of quality scientific outputs, both from Indonesia and from Australia. That had finished in 2005. 10 years later, what have been the impacts of those scientific outputs, and how do we capture how that knowledge has transferred to what ASIA wants to document, which in the end are social, environmental, economic impacts. So we came up with these project objectives with Andrew Alford, and we largely were focused on how the knowledge was being used by policymakers, research centres, and the peanut industry in Indonesia and Australia, because obviously ASEAN projects should have benefits to both recipient and countries and Australia. And the sub-objectives were focused on the extent to which science outputs led to greater awareness, the project itself, the extent to which it built stronger networks and linkages between Indonesia and Australia to explore that, continue that knowledge exchange, and the sustained adoption of technologies and knowledge. So ASIA's impact assessment series has been going out, happening for decades, and they've got fairly robust established cost-benefit analysis frameworks. But the changing nature of agriculture development and the changing nature of ASIA themselves indicated that new, different ways of capturing impact are necessary, because not all research investments will necessarily have economic benefits or quantifiable benefits. They'll also have, as we all know, capacity building, educational impacts, environmental impacts. So ASA needs a range of tools to capture those longer-term non-economic benefits. To see what the final, how their projects have long-term social, environmental, economic, ultimate impacts. So we, a collaboration between Susino and you and ASIA, we thought, well, knowledge flows and knowledge exchange is a major industry that ASIA is part of, and all that knowledge exchange happens and will be absorbed and used differently in different developmental contexts that we heard earlier today and throughout the conference. So the issues of who gets along with who, the politics of development, influence how knowledge and science is absorbed by stakeholders and applied. So we said there's existing frameworks to capture both contextual relevance and knowledge flows. These could be useful for this project, the peanut project, to look at the longer-term knowledge exchange and the impacts that's had on something, on policy, on awareness, on linkages. We drew then from established frameworks, so knowledge systems, which has a big body of literature from Harvard University, which is, at its core, is relatively straightforward. It's about how different knowledge actors, NGOs, policymakers, they're all knowledge actors, how they interact and exchange information about particular issues. And the extent to which knowledge is basically credible, in terms of quality, salient, in terms of relevance for the context in which it's being produced, and legitimate. So the extent to which different knowledge stakeholders participate in knowledge creation. So that was, we drew from that idea, okay, knowledge systems are a way of exploring how technical outputs flow between stakeholders. And the critique we had of knowledge systems was it was missing that developmental relevance of context matters and politics matter. So how do we, where can we draw from people that have done this research to policy impacting dynamic environmental, dynamic developmental contexts? So that's where we turn to the people from the Overseas Development Institute in the UK and the research and the policy impact framework that they have, which is, again, in simple terms, how research produce impacts policy in development contexts. And they've got a huge database of literature and case studies of how they've applied that framework. And they focus on these four factors here at the top of context, linkages, evidence and external out-of-your-control factors that influence how research impacts policy. So we said, all right, over time, ACIA's projects will be completed. They often, hopefully, deliver quite good papers, technical outputs, and over time, those outputs will be absorbed depending on all these different interacting knowledge flows and contextual matters. So in this relatively, hopefully simple way of capturing knowledge flows in the development context, we looked at how did that unfold in Indonesia given the aflatoxin context I mentioned earlier. It was a relatively, for lack of a better word, small impact assessment, and it was qualitative in nature because most of the researchers involved were still active in the field of peanut research. We also had linkages with Indonesian policymakers who worked in establishing almost baselines for minimum aflatoxin presence in the value chain. And we also were interested, because a lot of these investments went to universities in Indonesia. We were very interested in how that knowledge has been used over the last 10 years to educate new Indonesian researchers in peanuts and these technical tools. So we also looked at the general impact of publications and student flows who have graduated from academics that benefited from ACIA funds in the early 2000s. And the qualitative data, we basically structured both interviews and analysis around those ideas of knowledge flows and how that knowledge is used in the specific Indonesian context and what has led, if at all, to the absorption of ACIA knowledge. So two general discussion, well, there's a number of discussion points in the report, but I'll give you two of them. So the impact on the Indonesian level on research, so these are universities, and the impact on policy. So at the research level, we found, based on our discussion and work, that the impact was quite high, and we assessed that highness through things like number of graduated students, publication tracking, the extent to which researchers that were funded by ACIA are still being able to acquire funding to continue their work. So the actual quality, the credibility of that research remains quite high. And a lot of interviews narrated how ACIA was pivotal in training these academics, researchers in the technical skills that they needed to pursue further research. Some of the barriers, the realities in Indonesia, context that had prevented research from being absorbed was largely around communication and stronger linkages with government agencies. Obviously, the scale of Indonesia in terms of population and linkages creates a barrier for linking people. One of the things ACIA did do and was happened after ACIA funding expired was the establishment of the Aflatoxin Forum of Indonesia. So that was a core organization that I believe until a couple of years ago was still active, and it was explicitly targeted at linking researchers with policymakers. So the aflatoxin science would hopefully inform monitoring aflatoxin policy in Indonesia, and I'll get to that in the next slide. And these researchers are renowned as regional experts in this space. So they're the people to go to for aflatoxin in Indonesia, and it's the ASEAN region. They're still going to conferences. So in terms of research output, it was quite high. Policy impact, as we know, we've heard today in previous presentations, is extremely hard to capture. There's a range of quantitative tools. There was a seminar this morning on it. We focus on how the knowledge influenced policy. The major change that direct policymakers attributed partially to ACER, obviously ACER didn't do everything, was the establishment of a baseline of the minimum aflatoxin levels to be present in the value chain, to be monitored at that wet market. So ACER identified, if you want to find aflatoxin, find it at the informal market. And then through the science and the aflatoxin forum, they established the 15 parts per billion as the minimum, maximum level aflatoxin present in peanuts. That's, according to UN, it's the minimum level, maximum level where humans won't be affected. A number of policy issues regarding awareness of aflatoxin, things like they don't want to scare consumers because it's a growing industry. So their advertising campaigns have been relatively low. But in general, the policymakers we spoke to said the knowledge that has come out from these Indonesian agencies has helped us understand the risks of aflatoxin and understand potential strategies on managing aflatoxin. Got 2 minutes, maybe 1.5. So this framework, I think, again, relatively small project for us, and the aflatoxin project was a small project as well, but hopefully is a start of capturing those broader knowledge exchange in complex context impacts of ACER work. So ACER is going to continue to invest in ever-growing, challenging developmental contexts, and they want to achieve economic, social, and environmental outcomes, they're going to need different tools that are flexible and adaptable to those contexts. And we hope that what we've done is evidence that they are able to capture the impact of the research on knowledge exchanges. They deliver really often quite high quality science, technical output. Does that science lead to developmental outcomes? That's a question that we think ACER is engaging in now. And final slide is, what is the purpose of this report and the work we've been doing with ACER is, at its core, it's about how knowledge is absorbed and exchanged between people. We think that's very valuable in the back end of projects, so 10 years after they finish, to assess their impact. We think these ideas are also relevant at the front end of projects, when you're designing your science projects, to see how that science is going to be used and how it's going to flow. And finally, the theoretical contribution the paper has made, hopefully for ACER and for the literature, is that integration of well-established knowledge systems and rapid frameworks as evidence of how they're relevant for agricultural development. Thank you.